Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced at the Melbourne Community Support Program and brought to you through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, Rob Greaves here once again, bringing you part two of a three-part program on the life and times of 65-year-old David Pepperell. In part one, we learned that David decided, at an early age, that the life and style of his parents was not for him, although he is the first to admit that many traits, including his love of literature, came as part of his upbringing. His number one love is music, and in part one, we shared stories of his early exposure to a wide range of music. We also learned why he developed a second persona to deal with bullying at school. This is a persona that will come back to haunt him in later life. David's intimate and first-hand experiences of bands and venues in Melbourne, including the development of the pub rock scene, will educate, if not entertain. Now, to part two, where we pick up on the discussion about the early Australian rock and pop scene. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned Johnny O'Keefe because, largely forgotten these days. Would you say it's fair comment that he was largely responsible for developing a rock and roll scene in Australia?
Oh, of course. Look, I think we've only really produced three, you know, mega rock stars, you know, and I leave Farnham and Jimmy Barnes out, which might be unkind. I think basically Johnny O'Keefe, Billy Thorpe and Normie Rowe are the three really great stars we produced. I've never seen anybody kill a crowd like those three. You know, they were exciting, they were innovative, they had everything going for them. They were wonderful acts. Look, Jimmy Barnes might be great, Farnham might be great, but they never moved me like those three did. They didn't create the ecstasy that those three created. I think out of all of them, I saw O'Keefe at the Meyer Music Bowl. It was the only rock and roll concert, the Meyer Music Bowl, for about 10 years, because I think they trashed the place afterwards. I think the next one they had was the Go Show, which was okay. Then they had AC/DC, and that was the end of Meyer Music Bowl for another 10 years as well. But it was this incredible show there, and I saw Johnny O'Keefe come on, and he did about five numbers, and this phalanx of girls jumped the moat, jumped everything, and chased him off the stage. And I don't know if it was faked or not, but he ran out the back for his life and apparently jumped in a car. But he just killed him. I think that may have been the only time I ever saw Johnny O'Keefe perform, because he didn't come to Melbourne very often.
No, that's right.
And I was too young to go to rock dances, you know, in the 50s. You know, yes. I was far too young. I mean, and also they were incredibly rough.
That's right.
O'Keefe, you know, was the first guy to really sell records, to have hit records here. He used to go to all the radio stations and beg them to play his records. You know, he put on his own dances. He was extraordinary. When he came to Melbourne, of course, it was a tremendous event, and he got 6 o'clock rock going, without which we wouldn't have had a rock scene here. TV's so important. If you think of all the stars that came out of 6 o'clock rock, Barry Stanton, Warren Williams, Lucky Starr, Lonnie Lee, all acts that Johnny Devlin that sold lots of, they were big stars. They were all Sydney at that time because there was no Melbourne scene, which Stan Roaf used to talk about a lot. But it was, you know, they were real rock and roll stars, those guys. Johnny Reb and the Rebels, you know, they had hit records.
Now, you mentioned a name there that's interesting too. You mentioned Stan Roaf, Stan the Man. If there was ever a person that was so involved in music without being a musician, it would have been Stan, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Look, Stan is created the Melbourne scene, which culminated really in Melbourne becoming the hippest city in Australia, and I think one of the hippest cities in the world. At one stage, really, I think the rock and roll cities of the world were, let's say, London, Paris, Los Angeles, New York, and Melbourne. Yeah. I think they were the major cities in the world for rock and roll music. And I'm justified in this by what overseas bands said, you know, major bands said, who came here. Look at the crowd we got in Melbourne to see the Beatles, 250,000 people.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Stan Roaf. The greater three
you say. That's why I sing, because she wears my ring.
I really enjoy playing that record, especially for our kiss and cuddly couples here at 3UZ every night, Monday to Friday, between midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning. I know that Sam Anglesey does too, by the way, and Sammy will replay that record this Sunday night between 6 and 12 midnight. Stan Rowe Show at 316. Make it go with you, the bread that time. And that record really is climbing our 3UZ official top 40 chart. 19 record last Sunday, record number 13 this Sunday.
So Stan's radio show was incredibly influential. I started listening to it. Oh, I was probably at about 10, so when was that, about 1955 or something. Where Stan was different to the other radio stations was that he concentrated on the American Cashbox chart. He didn't bother about what sold in Australia. What he bothered about was what was selling in the United States, which was the major market at that time. So what he played mainly at that time was rhythm and blues, was a lot of black music, because black music at that time was enormously big in America. It was a major music. In 1960, out of the top 100 of the year, 60 were by black artists on the Cashbox chart that year. And acts like Ike and Tina Turner, Bobby Bland, Billy Bland, so many acts. And the Motown acts like Mary Wells, the Miracles, the Marvelettes, they were all really huge hit acts. And I first heard Motown records on Stan. I first heard of Phil Spector's records on Stan Rowe, the Ronettes, the Crystals, who I really adored. But so he gave Melbourne, there was no other station doing this in Australia, an international view of the world, which was very similar to what was happening to the Beatles and those sort of groups in Liverpool. Because in Liverpool, as they had American sailors coming in, the American sailors found out the kids liked American records, which they couldn't buy there. So they started bringing in a suitcase full of records every time they came to Liverpool and flogging them to the kids for double the price on the docks. It was a very lucrative trade.
Yes.
And so what I was really amazed about when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones particularly started was it was all the same records I had. All the stuff that they played, You've Really Got a Hold on Me, Devil in a Heart, I had all those singles because we were mad on that music. And I bought some, a lot of them were released out here. They were all mostly flops because the radio stations didn't play them. And they'd usually wind up for 2 and 6 at Foy's, you know, or Batman's. So I built up this huge collection, especially Motown Atlantic, soul stuff, what's called soul now, we used to call it R&B. And all of a sudden I found the Beatles and the Stones liked the same records I did.
I should say to people listening that David played a very big and very important part of a role in Melbourne through the 60s and into the 70s, both musically and certainly writing, which we'll come to a little later. But when did you start to have first-hand involvement in the music scene?
I thought myself as a bit of a singer. So I'd been a boy soprano at school. And I'd always sang. I used to sing along with the radio all the time and things. And I thought that I could probably sing. So in 1964, I was working as a clerk at Royal Insurance in the city. I'd left school in 62 after fifth form, at the end of 62. And a guy I worked with told me he played drums. I thought, oh, that's sort of interesting. Then he mentioned that his brother also played guitar. I thought, well, guitar, drums, me, singer, that's like, you know, three-fifths of a group.
Yes.
And so I'd say, can I see you guys play? Because I knew they'd invite me out then because everybody wants to you know, clown around and show off. And I thought, you know, guitar and drums can play together so I can actually make some approximation of a band. So if I go out there and I get them to play something, I could sing and they would see that I would be the guy to sing with them. It could have gone horribly wrong, but it went really right. Though when I went out there, we spent this whole afternoon and we just sang all the stuff I knew, like Walking the Dog and things, Rolling Stone stuff as it was known by that time. And so we decided to form a band. And we eventually got a bass player in and another guitarist, and we called the band The Union. We started off as The Boys, which wasn't very imaginative. But the weird thing was that we rehearsed for a year and a half before we ever did a gig.
Wow, that's unusual.
Well, because we never thought we were as good as the Beatles, you see. So we thought we'd just keep on rehearsing until we get to about that level. A guy called Rod DeGrucci saw us, which is really funny because Rod died actually a couple of weeks ago. And he was Wayne DeGrucci's brother. And Wayne was a big manager at one stage, managed John Paul Young and the All-Stars, and before that, he actually managed Axiom. Anyway, Rod had seen that his brother Wayne was a manager. He decided he wanted to be one, and somehow he heard about us. So he came to see us, and by this time we had a repertoire of about 60 numbers and about 10 original tunes. So, I mean, when we went out, most bands had a repertoire of 10 numbers.
That's about it.
They were onto requests by the second set and no original numbers at all.
No.
So we were quite good. And we wound up doing our first gig ever at the Thumping Tum. It was the third Saturday of the Thumping Tongue. The first Saturday night, which I'd gone to, was the Spinning Wheels. The second Saturday night was the group, and the third Saturday night was us. And we killed them. We just knocked them dead. I always remember that the only funny thing was that night that we didn't know how to play Gloria.
I thought everybody played Gloria.
We were very disconnected. The band was really funny. I mean, I lived in you know, in Tacoma. The two brothers lived in Footscray. We really had no connection to other bands at all.
Yes.
We were quite isolated. So, and I didn't go to dances and things in Melbourne much because I couldn't get home, you know, as the last train went at midnight, you know.
Yes.
I didn't do it much, and, you know, they'd done it a bit. But so we didn't really know that that time Gloria was played by every band in Melbourne. It was the tune.
That's right.
And that night, they at 12 o'clock, they paid us another £5 each to play till 2. And they paid us another £5 each to pay until 3.
Wow.
So that night we got £15 each for the gig. At that time I was working for £8 a gig at Royal Insurance.
So you thought you had a good thing.
Well, we had no expenses.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have to provide a PA or anything. We had no roadies. Everything was just in the back of our cars. So we just turned up there and played and got £15. It was extraordinary.
Now, I'm not going to let you get away with the throwaway line of, oh, we played at the Thumping Tum, because for people listening, especially people interstate that are listening, who may not have known of the Thumping Tum, it was the place, wasn't it?
It was a major gig. In a lot of ways, it was the Speakeasy or the Whiskey a Go-Go of Melbourne. You know, if you want to talk about famous gigs in other cities. It was the place where all the bands went after gigs, etc., to hang out. It was very Turak-y and rich. All the rich private school boys and girls went there and dressed up in full mod clothes. It was full of old antiques and things. And it had an amazing design, and that Ron Eaton, who designed it, made a false roof from upside down umbrellas. He hung umbrellas
that.
From the roof. Yep. And so there was this whole roof wall
Brilliant.
Of umbrellas
Brilliant.
When you looked up. It was beautiful. It was featured in practically every magazine in Australia, like women's magazines,
yeah.
like Women's Weekly and things. Everybody came in and took a photo of it. So, yeah, it was a big deal, and it was quite amazing us as a completely unknown band playing there.
It certainly was, because the next week you could find Max Merritt in the Beefeaters.
Oh, yes,
everybody.
Oh, and the Twilights and the Masked Apprentices. Anyway, so we played that week and killed them. So during the week we had to learn Gloria. I went out and bought Gloria on Monday. And we came back next week and we played it 15 times in a row.
Wow.
Every time we stopped, they said, play it again. And again, we went through till about 2 o'clock in the morning. So that was fantastic. And then we played 10th Avenue, Pinocchio's. We played for a long time. And then we were approached to do a dance craze for the Thumping Tum. We'd become almost known as the Thumping Tum band. We played there so often. They knew we wrote songs ourselves, so we came up with this song called The Thump, which was supposed to be like The Twist or The Frug or anything else. It was going to be, and they got Anthony Rodriguez, who at that time was probably the only black man in Melbourne. He was Melbourne's token black. He was this Cuban-American dancer. He was a beautiful guy, beautiful looking, incredible dancer, and he worked out this dance called The Thump. So we had this night of thump at the Tum, which was filmed for Go. And we actually, you know, we appeared in film on Go. We didn't perform on Go ever, but we were filmed for it. And the very first issue ever of Go Set, in the middle pages, had a double page spread on the thump.
Did it ever get released as a single?
Oh, yes. It was on a small label called Trend, which prior to that had released the first Town Criers single and a Glenn and the Outlaws single, another great band, great forgotten band in Melbourne. And it got in the radio. We were played in 3UZ. And it got us quite a lot of work. It wasn't a hit, unfortunately, but things like that were hard. It was on this... it was a very early, in a lot of ways, indie single.
Yes.
There weren't too many indie singles in those days. Johnny Kay had put out his Big Boat Up the River on MB Records, but there weren't that many. And the guy who recorded it at Theatre Sound was a guy called John Morrison, who wound up being the chief sound man for all of the Channel 9 Tonight shows, you know, including Don Lane, Bert Newton, and was also one of the partners in the Sunbury Rock Festival.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time.
So the union existed for about a year and a half, and we did okay. We appeared on Commotion. We actually appeared, you know, used to go in and on a Saturday afternoon you'd do three songs, and so we did The Thump and The End, the flip side, on Commotion. But in the end, we broke up, you know, through the usual infighting that happens with bands. I had a lot of trouble with my voice, which was unfortunate. I haven't got a very strong voice. And what I did find was that I could do about one or two gigs and my voice would virtually clag out, which tended to annoy the other guys in the band.
Because, mind you, persistence was great in those days.
There was no fallback.
Yeah.
So you tend to sing very loud, you know, so you could at least hear yourself a bit, you know. And I used to do the old thing of covering one ear. You're quite right. I think many, many years later, when I actually did a gig with fallback, I didn't shoot my voice at all, you know, because I could actually, that's right, it was very hard. And they were crap PAs. I mean, they were just like a speaker and a baffle board hanging from a wall and things, you know. It was very difficult. But I had trouble with the voice. And look, we sort of broke up through musical differences in that I wanted to sing music and they didn't want to play it.
That's a big difference.
So that's what happened. Really, if they had gone with me, I mean, because I had this tremendous record collection, I wanted to do interesting songs out of that, and all they wanted to do was what was on the new Beatle album, you know, which was a bit, I think we could have been a very interesting band. If you look at years later when Camp Act formed out of friends of mine, and they did all stuff out of their record collection, etc., and they became like a really big band. Yes. And they had a hit with I'm Your Puppet, which nobody had done.
Yes.
And I think if the band had have done stuff that I wanted to do, like Chuck Jackson stuff, Bobby Bland stuff, you know, I think we could have been a very interesting group.
You mentioned a little earlier about one of the problems were that you were so isolated geographically from everything else in living in Tacoma. And yet, about the same time that I met you in the, 65, you that stage, you were very much involved firsthand with a lot of musicians in Melbourne. How did that come about?
You probably met late 65. Well, I'd met some. You know, it was, as I say, it was totally weird in the union because we didn't know anybody else. I didn't know any musicians at all. I didn't know anybody playing in another band. Late 1965, I got fired from my job. I'd left Royal Insurance mid-65 and I'd gone to work as a customs agent because I was sick of sitting around in an office. And that'd give me a lot of freedom because I could come into town. I used to do clearances through the customs house in the city and I was out of the office a lot. I got fired and I was just wandering about and I thought I'd go up to Royal Insurance and see the guys there and see what they were doing. When I got up there, one guy there said, you got to meet, we've got a guy here who plays in a band, you got to meet him. So I met him, and that was Chris Stockley, who at that time was in a band called The Roadrunners, who were a really terrific band, and they did pretty much what I always wanted the union to do. They were playing all R&B stuff, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, Bobby Bland, everything, all the stuff I wanted to play. I was very jealous of them because I could never get the dags in my band to play anything interesting. I managed to get them to play positively 4th Street, and that was about the best I did. So I met Chris and we instantly became friends, and through him I met their drummer, Bob Tregilgris, and we spent an afternoon just playing records at Bob's house one afternoon, decided we'd get a house together. So we managed to get a house in Spring Road, Malvern, and through that I met all the people they knew and they met all the people I knew. The people I knew were musical, but not musicians.
Right.
And I was in a group of people who were really into American R&B and black music, etc. And we just bought music by the truckload and just sat around and played all day. We're basically geeks. We didn't go out much at all or anything like that. We didn't really have girlfriends much at all. I think we were a bit too geeky. But music was everything to us, and we knew a lot about it. And when I met Chris, like, he knew about a whole area of music I didn't know a lot about, which was Electric Chicago Blues. I'd heard the names. I'd heard Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters, Little Walter, but I was not familiar with the music. Whereas me, I had everything by everybody on Motown, Atlantic, VJ, even some Chess stuff, and which we used to call Modern Rhythm and Blues those days before it was called Soul. And so we cross-pollinated between the two of us, you know, and we just had these tremendous records. And also, Chris was a big fan of the Yardbirds, who he'd seen and knew who Eric Clapton was, who I'd never heard of. So there was an enormous thing between us. And Bob and I were very interested in jazz as well, which I was interested in. So we formed this whole group and we got this house. And through that, I met people like Mark Barnes. I met John Pugh, who was singing with the Roadrunners at that time. I met John O'Brien, who later on became their singer. I brought in people like the Williamson brothers, who are mad record nuts. I met you. It became quite a big gang. We lasted in Spring Road about 7 months, and by the end of that, the gang was about 20 people, I'd say, at least. You know? And a very tight gang. And Chris's band were the Roadrunners, who later changed their name to the Delta Set. The union had broken up, certainly by midway in 66. A few bands started to get formed, like a band called Ain Century Quartet was formed out of Keith Glass, who I met at that time, and John Pugh, who'd played with Chris. They knew a lot of people. They knew Ross Wilson, and we got to know the guys in the Adderley Smith Blues Band, which was Karen Tolhurst and Fat Fred and Graham Matters and Mark Dindus and Howling Wolf, Brian Snowden, and a lot of those people. So it really became quite a large group of people.
So to be fair to say, realistically, in terms of the Melbourne scene, through that early to the middle part of the 60s, you were right where it was really happening.
Oh, yeah, I was ubiquitous in those days, because we lived at the Thumping Tum, we lived at 10th Avenue, and then, of course, the Catcher opened up around about 68, I think it was, and that was the most wonderful gig ever in Melbourne. Yeah. And Camp Act. By this time, Chris and Keith Glass and Mark Barnes and initially Bob Tregilgus had formed Camp Act. And they'd become a popular band. They'd had a couple of hit singles, and they were also always on at the Catcher, as was the Adderley Smith Blues Band, who became, again, our great mates. Look, in those days, I would have gone out every night of the week.
Now, there's an old saying, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. And I think what that sort of meant was that it really was a matter of sex, drugs and rock and roll. Was how people saw the 60s. Would you agree with that?
No, not in Australia. No, the 70s is that in Australia. Really, there weren't that many drugs in Australia in the 60s, not till right till the end, as far as I remember. Gee, you know, marijuana was hard to get. I remember acid sort of hitting around, but it must have been about 69 or something, or 68 by the time acid really hit, you know. The 70s were far more sex, drugs. By the 70s, that kind of lifestyle was totally established. Everybody was smoking dope. Everybody was dropping acid. There was a fair bit of speed in the 60s. I remember speed being available around 66. That was really, I think, the drug of choice and the drug of opportunity. Marijuana and certainly heroin, I never saw any of those kind of drugs. That was far more, say, London and the United States, because again, they were closer to places where those drugs were smuggled from.
Well, before we move into the 70s, what do you think was some of the key things of the 60s?
The 60s was a magic time. I mean, I don't think the 70s was as good as the 60s. What was great about the 60s was, firstly, that I think the scene in Melbourne was the equal of anywhere in the world. We had so many venues and so many gigs. You've got to think, there were something like 12, maybe 14 town hall dances at that time. And most of them were big town halls, Box Hill, Coburg, Kew, Geelong, that held anywhere between 500 and 1,000 people. And most of those dances were like about 5 bob or 10 bob to go to, and you would see 5 or 6 bands, generally including like a top hit band, you know, of the level of Billy Thorpe, Ray Brown, Johnny Chester, Normie Rowe, the Master Apprentices. You know, you'd have a fabulous night out. Along with those, there were the discos, which were unlicensed at that time, the Thumping Tum, 10th Avenue, Pinocchio's, Biting Eye, Ginza, that were mainly in the city area. There were so many gigs in Melbourne. When Go Set began in 1966, they used to have like a double-page spread of gigs that were on Saturday night in Melbourne. It was just massive. So everybody went out. And, of course, there were suburban gigs. I mean, you know, I went once to a Bentley basketball court, you know, and there was a gig there. The whole of Melbourne was just completely booming with rock music. And there were so many bands. There must have been maybe 50, you know, bands playing in Melbourne at that time. Many have you know, been forgotten, but were playing either semi-pro or pro.
So it was a win-win because the musicians were getting the work and allowing to develop their skills. The everyday person in the street were able to go to these and have a really good time.
Oh, yes. And also bands were making really good money in those days. With the big dancers, you could become what was called a spot band. If you had a hit single, you became a spot band. And so at one of the big dancers, you'd be billed there and you would just come on for half an hour. You generally use the equipment of one of the other bands that was playing for the night, one of the backing bands or house bands. You take your own guitars and maybe the drummer would take his own snare. But you just plug in, play for half an hour, you play your hit single and a few other things and run off. Now, most bands could do three. Some did four spots on a Saturday night. They would do Coburg Swinger, then St Kilda Town Hall, then Param Town Hall, and maybe, God knows, somewhere else. And you were paid $500 a spot for those shows. So if a band did four spots the night, that was $2,000
turnover.
Which
was a lot of money then.
Well, good heavens, people were working for sort of, you know, $12 or something, or $15. Let's be kind, let's say $20.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were making this massive amount of money. Bands, I think, made more money late in the 60s when this was going than I think at any other time.
Join David and I next week for the conclusion to this unique story of what is largely considered as the counterculture scene, as it developed by the baby boomers. It's a warts and all expose that is humorous, sad, amazing, and not always legal. Next week, the final part of the story of David Pepperell, also known as Dr. Pepper, on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.